Andrew McConville, Chief Executive of the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
Now, I've got a correction to make, because we actually organised this interview thinking that your big conference was here in Adelaide, and then we've discovered that it's been bumped off to Perth. Is that because of COVID?
Yeah, it is, David. So originally we were meant to be in Perth last year, yeah. And then we would have been in Adelaide this year. And right. Yeah, it's significant because it's probably the largest sector conference in the Southern Hemisphere. So a bit of a shame for Adelaide, but we're back in 23.
Right, so what we're about to discuss is going to happen in Perth in the next couple of weeks.
But yeah, that's right.
And eventually it'll come back to Adelaide.
Yeah, back in 23.
But anyway, look, where the conference is held is, I suppose, neither here nor there, really. What the opportunity here is to talk to you about fossil fuels. Mm. Now, right up front, you know, I drove here today in a car with petrol in it. Last night my house was warmed by a gas heater. So, you know, if it just turned into, you know, what are you going to do about your emissions? I mean, all of us come to this debate with dirty hands, don't we?
Well, I think what we do is we recognise where we want to get to, which is obviously lower emissions net zero by 2050. I think where the debate really comes around is how are we going to get there, and how are we going to get there quickly in a way that, you know, make sure that people can stay warm and we keep jobs. And so that's the challenge.
Okay. But does your industry accept that eventually it's got to close down?
I think what we accept is the need for a transition. And I think with the use of technology, you'll see the oil and gas industry will have a long, long future, much, much well out beyond 2050. But it'll be supported by technology that helps reduce or take the carbon out of those products.
But the International Energy Agency, it handed down that report a week or so ago, saying that, I hope I've got this right, that all new gas, oil and coal production needs to cease and needs to cease soon. Your industry doesn't accept that?
No, look, I think what the IEA report does is it looks at one scenario out of about 90 and it says this is one of the ways that we could get to a net zero future. But what it doesn't do, David, is it doesn't take into account how we can offset carbon, so how we can reduce emissions from using oil and gas, and it doesn't take into account where we also reduce emissions in other parts of the economy, like agriculture and so on. So it's a very narrow cast view.
But it did find, the IEA, that the energy sector holds the key to responding to climate change. Do you accept that actions taken so far fall well short of what's needed to limit temperature increases to 1.5 degrees?
I think we need to do more, absolutely. And we need to look at the ways in which we can help reduce emissions from using, you know, oil and gas as part of the energy mix. So we start to look at things like carbon capture and storage, the transition to hydrogen. These are the sorts of technologies that will help us get to net zero, and also the role that oil and gas can play in supporting renewables, very important here in South Australia particularly. So that's where I think the change and the shift is coming.
You might have a question for Andrew McConville. 1-300-222-891 is the number to call, and the SMS line, you know it, 0467-922-891. In a moment, we'll get on to carbon capture, because both the state government and the opposition, both sides think it's a great idea and we should get on with it. Other people are very sceptical about whether or not it works. But how much new oil and gas do we need to find in order to meet demand?
Yeah, so if we look at the IEA and its own numbers, what they say is demand for oil and gas in Asia, because you've got population growth, economies developing, demand for oil and gas in Asia will increase by about 52% between now and 2040.
So how on earth can you meet your targets to reduce emissions if you've got a demand like that?
Well, I think when you look at that demand in Asia, the first part is you're seeing some coal to gas switching. So between 2010 and 2018, we reduced emissions in Asia by about 500 million tonnes from coal to gas switching, because burning gas emits less carbon than burning coal. So that's the first thing. And every year, Australia's exports of natural gas to Asia are the equivalent of about 170 million metric tonnes of reduction. So there's that part of it.
Yeah.
It's also about recognising that you have to sort of because it's a consumption product, you have to keep producing in order to maintain energy sort of security levels. So part of that is just the constant churn, if you like, of the product. But, you know, for us, it's about looking at how do we use that product, yes, to support the firming of renewables. That's very important. How do we do it as people shift out of burning coal or indeed burning things like wood and dung, which is a very, very big part of the energy mix in Asia, so shifting out of that, which has very high carbon emissions, into natural gas. So it's about that shift as economies develop. And then it's also about how do you continue to supply that product to ensure energy security, something that a Western economy like Australia or the US or the UK, I mean, our economies have grown on the basis of having a secure supply of energy. And before David, I joined Apiar, I spent a lot of time in Asia, and energy security is the key driver of economic growth, and they haven't had that advantage. So we can play a really important part in that, and gas, as part of that energy mix, being a cleaner burning fuel, is going to be very, very important.
So this is the argument which says there's no virtue in driving or keeping third world economies in poverty in order to save the planet. That's pretty much the argument.
I think you've got to be able to do both. You've got to be able to ensure energy security and economic growth, whilst also, you know, everyone's very committed to net zero by 2050, to the Paris goals, and you've got to be able to do both. It's a bit like walking and chewing gum.
Yeah.
And the answer to that is in the sorts of technology. So, as I say, that shifting of your energy mix, and then how can we also look at ways to continue to reduce emissions through the way in which we use energy.
But those figures which you gave a few moments ago, saying that, look, we're actually cutting emissions in Asia because we're getting people off burning dung and wood and onto something more efficient, and if we can get them off, say, coal and onto gas, well, that's... But are they net figures? Because the environment, the planet, doesn't really care whether it looks good on a table that you produce in a report. What's important is the whether or not there is a net increase or a net decrease.
It's a really good point you make, David, and that's exactly right. What we're talking about is net emissions. So what are we doing to obviously use energy to generate economic growth and jobs and all that comes with that, but then offsetting? And that's why you talk about the IEA report. What you need to do is also look at, well, yes, what's the contribution our industry's making through producing hydrogen, carbon capture? What's happening in agriculture? You know, agriculture is a fantastic opportunity to reduce emissions. So what are we doing there? What are we doing to support the growth of renewables? So it's not either or, it should be and that's, I think, what a lot of people lose focus on in this whole energy debate.
So getting back to an earlier question, how much new oil and gas do we need to find in order to meet demand?
We need to continue to explore and develop. Australia has an enormous reserve of oil and gas, several hundred years worth, if it were to all be developed. But what we need to do is we need to continue to develop that, to continue to provide that sort of $50 billion worth of exports that Australia currently sends to Asia. We need to maintain our production at about those levels in order to ensure energy security for Asia.
Lots of text coming in on this. If you'd like to speak directly to Andrew McConville, he's Chief Executive of the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, give us a call, 1-300-222-891. But on the text line, lots of text coming in. One person, Parkside Pete, says, look, the future is not coal, gas or petroleum. The future is renewables. Renewables can meet the growing demand for energy. Yes?
I think renewables supplemented or supported by something that firms it up. So I think there is, you know, a very, very important role for renewables, but making sure that the reliability of supply is supported by gas. So that's in the electricity mix. But what I would say here, David, is I do think that people lose focus on the fact that electricity generation is one part of the overall energy mix. But when you talk about gas consumption, only about 30% of gas is used in generating electricity. The other 70% is used in manufacturing fertilizers, you know, smelting steel and aluminium, producing ammonia. So a range of other products, producing glass. Many of the products that we use in our day-to-day lives are produced using gas, and we need to ensure that we're able to continue to produce those products as well as electricity. And people talk a lot about renewables in the electricity mix, but I think we need to look at the whole energy equation. And if you look at the energy equation in Australia at the moment, 6% of Australia's total energy comes from renewables. So we've got a long way to go to get to 50%, let alone more. So it's about how do we get that mix right and ensure energy security as we do that.
Another listener says, there is not a single power plant in the world that captures more than 1% of carbon, and that is at the high end. Is that correct?
I don't know, David, whether that's correct or not, but I think what we can say is we need to, and we have the potential here in Australia to capture somewhere in the vicinity of about 300 million tonnes of carbon a year. We're a long way from that, but the technology is proven, and that's where we've got to get to, is to continue to be able to capture that carbon. And it can be done at the point of the power station, but it can also be done in using the very substantial natural basins that we have where that carbon can be stored.
So, and that's what Santos wants to do.
Yeah, so that's what we're looking at in the Cooper Basin. It's what we're looking at, what we're already doing at Browse in Western Australia. There's great capacity in Australia for these natural reserves, if you like, that have either had oil and gas in them, and then you can replace it with carbon. There's a lot of good geological foundations or geological sites in Australia that could store and capture carbon.
So how does that work?
It's pretty simple, really. I mean, it's literally piping the carbon and putting it back into the ground in the same way that oil and gas has been stored in these reservoirs for hundreds of years, millions of years.
So what you send, you dig up you strike the gas at Moomba, you put it in a pipe and you send it off to where it's used,
yep,
to turn a turbine somewhere.
Yep.
And then at that turbine, the carbon is captured, and you put it back in another pipeline.
Correct.
So you need two pipelines now.
It depends. Some of the technology is that you may be able to look at options to effectively reverse the process, but it can be trucked, it can be piped, and then it's put back into the reservoir. The reservoir is sealed, and it's stored there forever. It's a pretty simple process.
Well, it sounds pretty simple, but I mean, trucking the stuff sounds horrendous because that's going to involve energy, which means emissions. These aren't going to be electric trucks, are they?
They could be hydrogen. But
I think we're getting into the realms of the Jetsons here. Okay, yeah. So it would seem to moi, sitting here in a studio at 10 to 10 on a Tuesday, yeah, that you'd have another pipeline. So
that's
you've got to
correct.
Build another pipeline. Then you send it all the way back to Moomba and you shove that carbon back into the ground. That's going to be enormously expensive, and nobody's done it before, have they?
No, people are doing it. We're doing it here in Australia. We have the largest carbon capture and storage facility in Australia at Gorgon in Western Australia. They're doing it in Norway. Norway have very extensive carbon capture and storage. We absolutely have the ability to do it not too far up the road in the Cooper Basin. I mean, this is very tried and tested technology, and it can be done very economically, and it can be done in conjunction with obtaining carbon credits and so on. So, it's and rest assured, organisations will do this when it makes economic sense to do it, and it does, and it can be done, and it can be done safely.
Nigel has called ABC Radio Adelaide. Hello, Nigel. Good morning, Nigel.
It seems to me there's a lot of inaccurate lies going on. The example of coal and dung burning, I mean, that's irrelevant because any of those fixed carbons fixed from CO2 using photosynthesis occurred when the planet's climate has occurred in the recent past, in the last 40, 50 years. I think the relevant thing might be, in the case of this, might be losses of fossil carbon. So, for example, fugitive carbon losses is changing the planet, and I think this is inaccurately or not accounted for. So how can I test, how do I know this accurately accounted for?
Nigel, thank you for your call.
So I think, Nigel, what you're talking about is what they call fugitive emissions, so emissions that are created in the process of moving product around into different facilities. And here in Australia, fugitive emissions run at about sort of sub 1% of total production, and they are monitored and have to be reported every year. They're monitored by the CSIRO, and they are reported to the government every year, so they're fully tracked and accounted for.
Mark has called from Smithfield Plains. Hello, Mark.
Good morning, all. I'm just thinking that they're talking about carbon capture. I personally don't believe it at all, but maybe they could use it to grow stuff. Initially, around the power stations, they use it to grow trees for landscaping and then maybe use it for growing food. It may be small plots, but I don't know if that would work as an idea, just to spread it a little bit that way.
Mark, thanks for your call.
Yeah, certainly, Mark. I mean, carbon is a very important part of the agricultural process. I was in ag for 20 years before coming to Apius. So, yeah, it has multiple uses. It can be used in industrial processes as well. So,
yeah, but the point here is you need to take it out of the atmosphere.
Yeah, you exactly right. You need to capture it, and you can capture it through the production process, and the technology is getting to the point now where, you know, we will be able to capture it straight out of the atmosphere as well. So, you know, technology plays an incredibly important part, and I think that's what Mark's pointing to here as well.
Jenny's called from Prospect. Hello, Jenny.
Hello, yes. On the fugitive emissions are also when there are exploration holes. A lot of the exploration holes are not capped and are breaking down, and there is an assumption. There is no scientific data on it. They're not monitoring. The key thing is monitoring. They're not monitoring those exploration holes. So the assumption is that there is no methane leakage from them, and methane is the most dangerous climate warming gas.
Jenny, thank you for your call. Andrew McConville from the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association.
Yeah, certainly, Jenny, thank you. And that is the task of the CSIRO. They are monitoring, you know, across large parts of South Australia and Queensland, the Surat Basin in Queensland. They do widespread monitoring of methane leakage, and, you know, a lot of that also comes from agriculture, from cows in particular, and they track and monitor all of that. And, you know, our companies, when they come across these boreholes that are often used in the discovery process, they are capped and plugged, you know, in accordance with the requirements of government. So you're right, Jenny, they are holes that are used to explore, and our task is to make sure that when they are found, they are capped and safely, you know, safely blocked.
Did a shiver go through the oil and gas and coal industry when the court in the Netherlands handed down its decision requiring Shell to reduce its emissions? By 2030, Shell must cut its CO2 emissions by 45% compared to 2019 levels, the BBC reports, as a result of this court decision.
Yeah, look, I mean, the decision in the Netherlands was one that really said, you know, are we moving fast enough? And I think, you know, the key point here is that we all share that objective of net zero by 2050. We all are committed to the sustainable development goals, and what we have to do is focus on how can we get there as quickly as possible. And, you know, there was the court decision in Paris. There's been some pressure on, you know, some of the larger US companies as well, and I think that's in many ways, David, a good thing. It's part of the democratic process to make sure that we are doing everything we can to get the right technologies.
So the oil company won't appeal the decision?
I'm not sure what Shell will do. I haven't spoken to them about it. That's entirely up to them.
Because, I mean, you're sitting here as a representative of the industry saying, that's a great thing. We're all on the same page. We're all working towards the same thing. Well, the proof will be in the pudding, won't it? If Shell appeals against this decision, Shell will be saying, well, I don't think that's a very good idea at all.
Well, I think what Shell will be saying, what Shell are saying, is that, you know, we share the objective of net zero by 2050. We know that we all have a role to play. We know that technology is going to get us there. So I don't think there's any actual dispute about that at all, David. It's about how do we get there, and how do we get there as quickly as possible. And I think that's what we've got to focus on here.
How can you get there if you increase production, or if you bring on new production without proven technologies capturing the carbon?
Well, carbon capture and storage is a proven technology. It's being used in Australia. It's being used in Norway. It's being used in other parts of Europe. It's being used in the US. So, you know, it is a proven technology. That's one path. The second path is the role of gas in firming renewables, so we can get more renewables into the system. So that's the second part. And then the third part is technology like hydrogen, and gas will play a very important, very, very important role in helping us to produce hydrogen as well. So, you know, it's about using those technologies to take the products that we have to deliver that outcome, and I think that's perfectly possible.
The
David.
Interconnector, yep. That looks like it's going to happen. Now, earlier this morning we were talking to Tom Koutsantonis, who's a former energy minister. He predicts that if that power line goes to the eastern states, we'll have another interconnector to the eastern states. the gas that's currently being used to generate power in South Australia won't be needed, because we'll be getting it down the interconnector from the eastern states. That gas will then be sent off to the eastern states, where it will be used by generators there, and our gas generators will close down. Is that a reasonable scenario?
I had a bit of a chat to Tom about this one yesterday as well. Straight answer, David. I don't know how that's going to play out, but I think what we do need to do is put our faith in the national energy market regulator to make sure that that's why we have a national energy market, to ensure that we have the energy in the right places. And we do have a wonderful opportunity here in South Australia for production of gas. It's a significant resource. We need to make sure that we've got enough gas in the system to firm up the very heavy use of renewables here in South Australia, and that is the job of the national energy market regulator. So,
because that's the way you're selling gas now, isn't it? That gas is the friend of renewables.
Well, I think it's something that can certainly support the very strong uptake of renewables. But again, I make the point here, David, that is only one part of the energy mix. Electricity generation, one part. But what do we do for manufacturing process, producing fertilizer, ammonia, steel? We've got to look at the whole picture. And I think we often get a little bit distracted by the electricity debate and not talking about the energy debate. And I think that's very important as well.
Okay. Well, Andrew McConville, thank you for coming in.
Absolute pleasure, David.
And
great to see you.
Putting the point of view of the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association. Lots of text still coming in on that. And Andrew's about to leave the studio, but if you want to continue the conversation after 10 o'clock, you know the numbers, 1-300-222-891.